This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Life happens in a big way in WA, and Bupa backs our members through it all. That's why we're delaying our 1st of April premium increase for 6 months until the 1st of October 2022. Visit us in-store or search Bupa to find out more.
I suppose I've always got two hats on when I'm working. I'm a police officer, but first and foremost, I'm a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus. If I'm ever facing a situation and I think, oh, this is going to be a little bit hairy or a little bit sketchy, then for sure I'll be praying when I'm in there, and I'll be praying when I'm going out too.
It's Bale!
You know, I was at the Wales-Austria game, and to be there in the crowd when we'd won, and, you know, there was the music going, the light show at the end, the players coming around. Honestly, I don't think I'll ever experience anything quite like it.
Very few of us sit in congregations of 1,000 people or more in today's world. Watching Wales play rugby in the Millennium Stadium is about the largest gathering of people that most of us experience.
Hello, I'm Roy Jenkins. Welcome to All Things Considered. On the first Palm Sunday, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey to welcoming cries of Hosanna from pilgrims lining the streets. Days later, a crowd would be calling for his crucifixion. During his short public ministry, thousands had sometimes assembled to listen to his teaching and marvel at his miracles. On other occasions, he'd been asked to leave them alone and go somewhere else. Crowds can still show some of the best of human nature, as when huge numbers gather to raise money for communities in need or show peaceful solidarity with people suffering a great injustice. They can also be hideously ugly, as in the storming of the Capitol in Washington, and wherever they become a lynch mob targeting individuals who are different, whether that's in person or virtually through the manipulation of social media. Today we look at crowd behaviour and some of the questions it continues to pose for us. And we start with those events leading up to the crucifixion, when anonymous crowds were as important as many of the named characters.
I've often preached on those crowds, and I think it's very interesting, isn't it, with human nature. We can be swayed by a crowd. We can bay for somebody's blood one day, think they're fantastic the next. And I see that in daily life. I see that in public life.
The Reverend Dr. Manon Ceridwen-James is Dean for Initial Ministerial Training at the Church in Wales's St. Paddon's Institute.
I was looking through my Facebook feed, and a couple of years ago one of my daughters talked about Jesus and Barabbas, and Barabbas being voted off. I just thought it was so funny. It's like transporting those two stories into the X Factor world, or the kind of Big Brother world that we're used to. But I think those two stories, it just encompasses the whole of human nature, doesn't it? The fact that Jesus was glorified one week and they were baying for his blood the next.
Though, of course, it could have been different people in those crowds.
I think what we know about human nature is that we can be very changeable. So, you know, there's no way of knowing who was in those two crowds, but I'd like to think that they were a similar set of people.
It's the fickleness of human beings, isn't it?
Dr. David Kerry-Jones of Aberystwyth University has written extensively about the evangelical movement in the Wales of the 18th century.
We run after crowds. We run after the latest new thing. In the example of the Lord Jesus Christ, of course, people ran after him when he was running into Jerusalem because it was the thing to do. He was the healer, the celebrity. But as soon as his message perhaps began to hit home and the implications of it began to be more significant, that it involved death, dying to self as he was to die, then the weight of the message, the sacrifice involved in following Christ, meant that people ran very quickly away from him. And even his disciples at the end, there weren't many of them left standing around the cross with him.
Someone has counted more than 100 references to crowds in the Gospels. Matthew's alone accounts for more than 50 of them. Australian theologian Dr. Robert Miles of Wollaston Theological College in Perth.
The Gospels are ancient biographies, and one of the consequences of this is that it means that their authors had a vested interest in Jesus standing out from the crowd. Because of these literary interests of the Gospel authors, the Gospels promote the individual greatness of the central character Jesus. And what this means is that the crowds are often presented in a kind of more passive light. You know, they're astonished and amazed by Jesus' teaching and his deeds of power. They're recipients or witnesses to healings or what have you. Generally speaking, although there may be some exceptions within the Gospels, but generally speaking, they're not the ones who are driving events. I prefer to see Jesus as something of a religious organizer emerging from within the crowd, rather than the crowd radiating out from him. I think he becomes a conduit for the interests of the crowd. He's a singular figure who's able to convey deeper feelings about society at the time, the direction of society, how things are going. And that's all bound up with I think, his own critique on the current world order and his promise of a better world and a new society, which he calls the Kingdom of God. These people are attracted to Jesus and the Jesus movement, at least initially through the ministry of Jesus, precisely because he is able to rally their interests and give voice to their discontent.
Being part of a crowd can be a powerful, energizing experience. Having to address one can be daunting. Manon James.
I remember, you know, when I first trained as a preacher and as a priest, I was very nervous of crowds. But by now, I quite enjoy preaching and I quite enjoy speaking in public, so much so that I've even tried my hand at some amateur stand-up, actually. But in terms of my personal experience as a kind of a punter, I've been going along to the football matches, you know, the Wales play for quite a number of years. And of course, the feeling of being in that crowd is absolutely amazing. There's nothing quite like it.
It's Bale! Just magic!
You know, I was at the Wales-Austria game, and to be there in the crowd when we'd won, and, you know, there was the music going, the light show at the end, the players coming around. Honestly, I don't think I'll ever experience anything quite like it.
What do you think it did for you?
Oh, well, I think it messed me up, because I was on a high for days and I was having to work and be sensible and do sensible things. And it was very difficult because my mind and my body was elsewhere. You know, I was still in that crowd and with the music and with the players, but I had to try and concentrate. It was very difficult.
Transported.
Yes, yes, definitely, yes.
Almost a religious experience, some might think.
Yeah. Well, in my day job, I teach theology and pop culture. And to be honest with you, I think the experience of being at a game like that, it is a religious experience. It's definitely a spiritual experience. You know, whether we experience God as we know him, her, I would say that we do. But, you know, others may disagree. In the summer, you know, I like to go along to festivals. I'm afraid, because I'm a woman in my 50s, I enjoy going to 80s festivals and things. And it's fun because you talk to people that you wouldn't normally talk to and you just let yourself go in a way. But I think that's the same as in a football crowd, really. It's that feeling of togetherness, of enjoying something together, but with strangers.
Not all crowds are as joyous and uplifting as those Manon has experienced. Journalist Paul Vallely, author of a best-selling biography of Pope Francis and, most recently, a major study of philanthropy.
Gustave Le Bon wrote a famous study of the crowd in the 1890s, a Frenchman, and he said that when people are in a crowd, they cease to be individuals. They become the crowd with a kind of group sensibility, and it's usually worse than the individual because of the anonymity and the kind of this contagious susceptibility, and it comes down to the kind of lowest common denominator. The crowd moves in a certain bestial way, and it yields to kind of instincts, and there's something very unpleasant about the dynamics of a crowd as you lose your individuality in it.
And lose your inhibitions.
Yes, and you see this too in modern life. Hitler read his book, and so did Mussolini. And we know from Donald Trump's first wife, during their divorce, she revealed that Trump had a volume of Hitler's speeches next to his bed. So the kind of dynamics which bad leaders can play on are spelled out there, and some of this is quite self-conscious manipulation of the crowd.
Now, you've written occasionally about crowd behaviour, good and bad.
Well, I was trying to think about what the difference was between good and bad crowds. Going to the football, you get in a crowd of people walking up the road who are chanting, and you think, oh, I don't really want to be with this group. I don't identify with this. This is bad behaviour, tasteless or abusive or obscene or whatever. I mean, obviously, you're not going to go over and tell them that this is inappropriate behaviour, because that would just get you into serious trouble. But you feel like kind of complicit. And I've actually, on one occasion, gone up to an away fan and said, I'm sorry about these lot. We don't all think that. We're not all like that. But ordinarily, you don't do that. You're just kind of complicit on the edges. And there's a sense in which the worst instinct of the crowd is the driving force. I mean, Le Bon said something about people in a crowd go down several rungs in the ladder of civilization.
It's easy to condemn crowds which get out of control, but to what extent is anyone actually above the crowd, given particular circumstances? Manon?
Yes, I don't think we are above the crowd, are we? Because physically, even when you're in a crowd, you know, I've experienced this in a football crowd, you can't move. So when your team has scored a goal, people are being thrown around. So you can't be above the crowd because you physically can't move. And in terms of, you know, mentally, I think it is very difficult to stand up against the way things are going. And it takes a lot of courage.
And for some people, taking action against certain kinds of crowd behaviour is part of the job. Chief Inspector Stuart Bell led the David Powis Christian Police Association for 5 years. He's often been on duty at big events in Wales and beyond.
There was a time where the FA Cup and quite a few major sporting events came to Cardiff when Wembley was being refurbished. So I policed quite a few FA Cup finals there and sort of rugby league games and rugby union games. And for the most part, the atmosphere there was really good and really celebratory. And I'd be standing on point with a couple of other officers and we'd just have nice chats with people. So those atmospheres were quite nice. But I recall one FA Cup final where a gentleman was causing some problems. Me and a couple of other officers had to go right into the crowd and extract him, and that drew some attention and, you know, some name-calling, and that was a little bit tense. Common type of crowd we deal with is the nighttime economy crowd, where at sort of 2, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, a club full of several hundred people empty out onto a street. The atmosphere there can change very, very quickly if an incident happens. So everybody can be very, very happy. They've all had quite a few drinks and they're all waiting for a taxi home or going to get a kebab or something like that. And if there's a need to intervene to arrest somebody, or if a fight breaks out, or if somebody falls over and gets hurt, all of a sudden the atmosphere can change and it can go from being very jolly, very nice, to being a little bit more tense and there being a bit more of a feeling of police and public not being together, do you know?
I suppose I've always got two hats on when I'm working. I'm a police officer, but first and foremost, I'm a Christian, I'm a follower of Jesus. If I'm ever facing a situation and I think, oh, this is going to be a little bit hairy or a little bit sketchy, then for sure I'll be praying when I'm in there, and I'll be praying when I'm going out too. There's a tendency when you have a march or a protest and a counter-protest for people to become completely polarised. So if there's a, for example, a Brexit march and a Remain march happening at the same time, groups of people tend to think they are 100% right and the other group are 100% wrong, and there's very little room for anything in between, so you won't get any sympathies towards the beliefs of the other party at all, and vice versa. So it can become very, very divisive, and the role of a police officer then is to facilitate the peaceful protest of both parties whilst making sure that they don't cause harm to each other or cause any major public disorder.
Like, you see this on the internet, people lose their inhibitions, they've got the same kind of anonymity, they go on Twitter and they say abusive things in response to things that people have said, kind of things they wouldn't say in real life to people if they were facing them, but they're quite happy because of the anonymity to do that.
I think in any meeting or encounter, we can stop believing in ourselves, can't we, and believe that somebody else is saying, because they say it with such confidence. So I would say that that's been my experience more, is not believing in my own views.
You're a keen Twitter user. You've got, what, 1,600 or so followers yourself, and you follow a huge number as well. To what extent do you follow a crowd in your choosing who you will follow?
Oh, well, I think that's a good point. I think that's part of the problem of where we are politically now, isn't it, is that we think that, well, they call this an echo chamber, don't they, that we listen to people with the same views as us. So I think it's difficult because you obviously want to follow people who interest you, but there is a danger in that you just follow people who say things that you agree with, and then you don't get challenged.
Paul, some people, of course, simply shy away from a crowd and they say, well, you know, that's potentially going to go wrong. But in fact, is it not the case that in many instances, big movements have been seeded by events which have involved very big crowds? And they haven't necessarily been violent or objectionable or obscene or anything, but they have simply been a lot of people standing up for what they believe is right.
Yes, and I think you very often find that in those situations, the results are not immediate. I mean, if you look at people in Belarus who stood up in protest, or even now in Moscow, you get people standing in protest or just standing with a blank sheet of paper, and that's enough to get arrested. We don't know what's happening to them. We look at them and we think, well, that was brave, but was it foolish? But in fact, what happens as a result of that is that other people feel they're not alone. There are people who think like me, and they've perhaps been braver than I have. So it kind of seeds the possibility of resistance or dissent in the mind of the wider population. And when the time comes, the balance tips, and suddenly you find that everybody's not behind Vladimir Putin after all. It sounds like I'm being a bit down on crowds, but I'd like to kind of offer a different kind of experience. We went to a service in Manchester Cathedral recently, and it was the first time I'd been in that kind of situation since lockdown. And one of the things that I noticed there was, during the moments of silence, the silence of being in a group with 1,000 people is tangibly different to the silence of you being on your own when you're at prayer. There's something about that collective weight of the huge being together silence, which is something special. And I suppose that is a different kind of crowd dynamic.
For many Christians today, being part of a big crowd of fellow believers is a rare event. Yet some still measure the success of a preacher or evangelist by the number of listeners they attract, whether in mass gatherings or through television or social media. David Kerry-Jones.
If you're a preacher and nobody's going to listen to you, then that you have to call into question whether you're called and equipped to do the job, isn't it? And if nobody is prepared to come and listen to you, then perhaps you need to take the hint and stop the preaching.
You've just recently published a new history of Christianity in Wales. I mean, To what extent has Christianity here been a mass movement?
Well, at various points in the history of Christianity in Wales, there have been popular and populist movements that have that seem to have captured the imagination of people in Wales in a way that has been remarkable, really. The Methodist revivalists were able to reap a harvest from the educational initiatives of people like Griffith Jones, and people suddenly being able to read for themselves. You had the big public preaching meetings where people like Howell Harris or Daniel Rowland, George Whitfield when he came to Wales, would preach to tens of thousands of people at any one time.
There were vast numbers of some of these big preaching meetings. Presumably there were some elements in the crowd who weren't particularly supportive and who indeed jeered at them. What difference does that make?
Yeah, absolutely. There are famous pictures of George Whitfield preaching in London, in Moorfields and Kennington Common, big kind of outdoor gatherings, which were not only gatherings, not only sites where people gathered to hear preaching, of course, but where they gathered for all kinds of things. And there's a very famous picture painted of Whitfield preaching with people throwing things at him, with somebody else blowing a trumpet behind him, somebody else trying to pull him down from the pulpit. So he's preaching and battling against all of this extraneous noise that's going on. But these were, you know, Whitfield was taking religion out of the church, out of church buildings, out of sacred settings, and into the marketplace, where he was taking the gospel message, and it was competing with all kinds of other distractions, if you like, for an audience.
Observers, of course, have always talked about big religious meetings, evangelical revivals and all the rest of it, as being the vehicles of a great deal of crowd psychology, with people losing their rational minds, conforming to the mass movement. What do you make of that? Do you think that's a fair comment?
Well, with anything, there's an element. There must be an element of truth to that, isn't there? But unravelling what is from God, if you like, and what might be the result of other things is almost impossible to do, isn't it? And so the kind of claims sometimes that evangelists make can be too bold. It is very, very difficult. Whitfield once said that in his early ministry was confused by wildfire at times. And I think he could detect that with the good results of his outdoor preaching, for example, there was always a tendency to this kind of wildfire, this uncontrolled zeal that could lead to difficult results.
To what extent do you think the church needs a crowd of people in order to thrive? Manon?
Well, I think that's part of what we're facing at the moment as, well, Church in Wales and churches of every denomination, is that older people can remember times when churches were full. And I don't think churches were ever full every single week in our lifetime. But I think we can remember back to when, say, we had like a really packed harvest service or a really packed Christmas service. And then when we turn up to church and there's only 9 people there, it can seem quite depressing. But actually, I think that God is present, and we can have a spiritual experience however many people are there. So I don't think crowds matter in the end.
If Jesus turned up in Cardiff and he fed 5,000 people in Roath Park with a couple of loaves and a couple of fishes, I'd expect there to be a police presence and there to be some probably public interest in it.
Stuart Bell.
But the whole story of the Sermon on the Mount and shortly after the entrance into Jerusalem and then the crucifixion, it shows the power that man had and the impact that he had on people, good or bad. He challenged people and he demanded a response.
Crowds can be quite unpredictable, and they also have a lot of power that elites recognise, such that, you know, in the trial scene of Jesus, Pilate offers them Barabbas to kind of satiate their hunger for death and execution.
Robert Miles.
The actual negotiation between Pilate and the crowd, some biblical scholars, some historians will use this, the fact that the crowds turn on Jesus in the trial, as evidence of its non-historicity. Not only that, the idea that Pilate, the powerful governor, would actually engage with, you know, the common people. But I think such a perspective really underappreciates the actual power that crowds can have within a situation like that. You know, the fact that they, by their numbers, by their unpredictability, by the way in which they might have become quite frenzied on all sorts of ideas that happen when one loses that sense of individuality within a crowd. I think, you know, Pilate appears astute enough to want to satiate that hunger in order to diffuse the power of the crowd, to diffuse the threat of the crowd.
Back to the story of the Passion, there are these significant crowd scenes welcoming Jesus into Jerusalem, crowds being manipulated into shouting, "Crucify him." Where would you see yourself in those crowds, or maybe hope to see yourself?
Well, of course, I would hope that I wasn't one of the crowd shouting "Crucify," but I don't know, you know, if you or the listeners have ever been part of a kind of dramatised reading of this. I think there's something quite powerful being part of a crowd in a traumatised reading in a service shouting "Crucify him," because if we really believe that our sins played a part in the crucifixion, then it's an embodied way of being able to demonstrate that. So I don't know where I would have been on the day, you know, but I know myself, I know that I can be easily swayed.
And that's the problem, that the identity, that if you're going to place yourself anywhere on Palm Sunday or in Passion Week with those who were shouting "Crucify him," because that's the nature of human sinfulness.
You have to see yourself in both crowds. You have to see yourself in the joyful acclamation and the welcome of the Messiah, and then you have to put yourself in the other crowd and think about, you know, what situations have you been put in where you might think of yourself before others. We need to be wary about crowds, and we need to scrutinise ourselves when we're in a crowd.
Paul Vallely, and before that, Manon James, Stuart Bell, Robert Miles and David Kerry-Jones. My thanks to them all. You can hear this programme again via BBC Sounds, and All Things Considered returns at the same time next week. Until then, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.
Life happens in a big way in WA, and Bupa backs our members through it all. That's why we're delaying our 1st of April premium increase for 6 months until the 1st of October 2022. Visit us in-store or search Bupa to find out more.